White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Thanks for joining us tonight, February 27th, 2014, for our final program. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and...
I'm Hadding Scott.
Yes. Well, Hadding, we had to do a last show. It's hard to let this thing go. It's been a long run, exactly 20 months since we began the International Jew on June 28th, 2012. Which makes it 1 year and 8 months, almost to the day. Was the 28th, now it's the 27th of the month. So it certainly requires, I think, some reflection about what has been accomplished by this program. And I, for one, don't like to just say, well, okay, this one is over. Let's go on to the next or something. What comes up next? Without having gained knowledge and insight that will help us be more effective in the future. If anyone hasn't noticed, I take all this stuff very seriously. I'm a serious person. What about you?
I'm totally frivolous.
Come on now, let's be serious tonight.
Just a happy-go-lucky National Socialist.
Yeah, well, since when were a National Socialist happy-go-lucky?
It's possible to, I find many things to smile about.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, who would not want to smile? But I mean, I'm just saying, I think that there's a lot to be learned. I think there's a lot to be gained from the International Jew. And, I want to carry it forward and keep using it and keep taking it seriously. I don't know about your I don't know about you, so I'm asking you for your input here.
Well, there's a lot in there to chew on. There are a lot of topics in there that could be expanded. You know, I mean, William Pierce did that in regard to Jewish control of mass media, which is an important theme in there. That became Dr. Pierce's main theme, really. You know, and he had his publication called Who Rules America. There's a lot in there that could be treated that way. I made a list of some of the topics in there. Starts off with Jewish takeover of New York City, and that's an important one. And the behavior of the Jews as a cohesive, ethnocentric nation within a nation with its own political agenda. We talk about Jewish finance, Jewish organized crime, Jewish treason, Jews as Bolsheviks, Jewish control of mass media, I already mentioned, Jewish pressure on non-Jewish controlled mass media through advertising and so forth, Jewish warmongering, Jewish profiteering from war, the corruption of public taste and public morality, the Jewish degradation of commerce, particularly liquor. And they talk about men who stood up to the Jews. And they talk about the rejection of all, even the most reasonable criticism by the Jews. And there's always this theme, the recurring theme, of how there must be some reasonable Jews. And it's really just the unreasonable Jewish elite that rejects all the criticism.
Oh, that's a very good list. Do you have some more on that list? I'll comment on this one you just mentioned.
That's all I could think of.
Okay, yeah, and the this last one, I've been thinking about that for a few days, and I don't see how else they could have handled it. I don't think it's a fault in that, oh, they weren't hard enough on the Jews, because they were very hard for what compared to what anybody else was doing, and they were attacked for it in many, many ways all along. I've got a little bit about that. They couldn't say, well, you know, we found that Jews are so absolutely no good that we need to get rid of them, or we need to get them out of our country, we need to do this or that. There's no way they could have talked like that. So they had to say, well, we're really hoping, we're really calling for the more responsible members of the Jewish community to, you know, police, or not police, but, you know, to direct their own people away from these negative behaviors that they're involved in. They had to say that. But you never got any response from this more responsible community of Jews. You got criticism defending all the Jews from what they were saying. That's what you got. You didn't get any response, did you? I don't think so. Do you think
so? Well, I think they did say somewhere in there that they got some private responses from some Jews that said, well, you know, everything you say is right, but, you know, could you say it a different way? Something like that, you know. The Jewish establishment is what it is. And
well, Larry, if you say they say it's right, you say it a different way, well, then you're not going to get it across. So there again, you know, they're just not responding. They don't respond. They try to cover up. Let's see. That takes me. Let me just jump into something here. Unless you want to say more before we do this. Okay. I like that, your topics that you brought up. There's this thing about what the Jews do. Okay. All right. Here it is. I've got a little bit about Jewish reaction, that I actually got out of, this is a Wikipedia page. I think it's, about the Dearborn. I don't know which page it is, but says the Jewish reaction, it doesn't actually say what the Jewish reaction is. It says there are many accounts, now we know who's writing this, because this is from Wikipedia, there are many accounts of Jewish organizations coming together to fight the Dearborn Independent. The first major anti-Semitic article about Jews was published on June 19, 1920, and there were major repetitions on August 28, February, March, and November of 1921, I guess they thought these were the worst ones. The essay, Anti-Semitism, Will It Appear in the U.S., quoted Louis Brandeis as saying, and he was a justice of the Supreme Court at the time, and they wrote about how he advocated for Jewish civil rights and said, organize, organize, organize until every Jew must stand up and be counted. I suppose that was a criticism that that's not the way to lead the Jews, you know. And then they mention in here Lewis Marshall, who is written about quite a bit, that here's how they put it. Lewis Marshall noticed that the cause of world unrest, you know, that book you said you had read, The Cause of World Unrest.
Yeah, Gwynn, I believe, was his author's name.
Yeah, and that was kind of before the protocols or something, preceded the protocols. Was advertised.
No, I think he actually quotes the protocols, that book does.
Oh, it quotes the protocols. Okay. It was preceded the International Jew.
Yes.
Okay. It was advertised. Lewis Marshall noticed that on the back of one of the issues of the Independent, that book was advertised. So he wrote a personal letter to the publisher of the book, which was Putnam, you know. And the man's name at the time was Major George Haven Putnam. But we know the big Putnam case. And he Marshall condemned Putnam for his intolerance. That's the way they do it, you know. And Marshall said that Putnam was using Jews as his scapegoat. And eventually, Putnam apologized for his advertisement and for publishing the book. But we know that Putnam was forced into it through threats of destroying his publishing company. He was a big publisher at the time. He didn't think he was going to have to listen to Lewis Marshall, but in the end he did, because they organized or threatened to organize boycotts against him and put him out of business and so on. And it brought to my mind that Lewis Marshall at that time was doing the same work that Abe Foxman does now, in that Lewis Marshall was the one, he was head of the American Jewish Committee or something like that. And he was the one, like they say here, he noticed that this thing was advertised. He was the one who, whenever anything came up that was against the Jews or bad for the Jews, he was the one who wrote letters and said something about it. And he had this supposedly good reputation. Well, he certainly had a better appearance and reputation than Abe Foxman does today. But this is what Abe Foxman does. Anything and everything that comes up, Abe Foxman throws out a comment, you know, and writes to them and tells them, oh, you can't do this, and so on.
Yeah.
And that's really all that Lewis Marshall was doing back then. It takes away from some of the glamour of this man who they try to portray as this, you know, such a distinguished American, whatever he did. He was a lawyer. They're all lawyers. So then the non-Jewish reaction at the time was in the Federal Council of Churches of Christ in America. And now this would just be one of these things. There's quite a few of these Christian councils and so on, but it's probably a pretty big one. It published a resolution condemning Ford's propaganda and beliefs. And in January 1921, all right, that's where he still continued until January 1922, they issued a statement titled The Peril of Racial Prejudice. They denounced anti-Semitism as un-American. Guess who was behind that? And condemned the Independent for its anti-Semitic campaign. It was signed by more than 100 prominent citizens of, quote, Gentile birth and Christian faith, unquote, including President Woodrow Wilson, former President William Howard Taft, William Jennings Bryan, Clarence Darrow, Robert Frost, you know, some other names, a bunch of names I'm not that familiar with, plus the presidents of Williams, Oberlin, and Dartmouth colleges, and Princeton, Cornell, and Syracuse universities. Now, that's a lot of pressure, you see.
Yeah.
And that didn't stop the Dearborn Independent from continuing. So he stood up to all that. He didn't. What got him finally was that trial, you know. And then it goes on to say that there was action by the Anti-Defamation League, which existed back then. They were doing that already, although Abe Foxman wasn't there then, I don't suppose. And they began a concerted effort to oppose the Independent, and they led a coalition of Jewish groups. They raised objections by writing things in the Detroit press. They organized a boycott of Ford products, which was supported not only by Jews, but by several liberal Christian groups. But now we jump ahead to 1927, you know, and that we know that a lot took place before then. So his apology came about in 1927. But what was going on between January 1922 when he stopped writing the articles that are a part of the International Jew, and that libel lawsuit, which took place in, well, in 1927. Yeah. And so I was looking for that. But you want to comment on anything that I've said here?
Well, while I was listening to you talk, I thought of four more topics.
Okay.
The Jewish attack on non-Jewish institutions. Specifically, mm-hmm. Christianity.
Yeah.
The Jewish demand for special treatment.
Yeah.
With that, the Jewish double standard. And also Jewish lackeys. Jewish lickspittles. People who serve the Jews willingly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So there
well,
you go.
You know, considering all that they covered in that period of time, would you say that they pretty much covered everything? Or do you think that there's something, you know, that stands out that they left out?
I think they covered everything and even stretched a little bit on maybe one or two points.
So, you know, they were accused of being anti-Semitic, and they are just, they for some reason, they had these horrible bigoted views, and that's why they were doing it. Whereas, you know, our opinion on that is that they saw the danger, and they saw that what Jews were doing had done all over in Europe, and what they were now coming in hordes to America, what they were going to do here, and saw the evidence of it already, you know, like in the entertainment world and so on. So they thought they better, they had an opportunity here to bring it to the attention of the American people because of Ford's popularity. He had bought this newspaper already and, you know, things like that. So, you know, I don't think that, that it was based on a bad motive. It was based on a motive of trying to help the American people understand what was going on.
Well, you know, there's one point that they didn't cover, but probably because it wasn't as prominent back then, and that's the Jewish role in fomenting racial unrest. In other words, turning Negroes against white people. But they weren't doing that as openly at that point.
No.
I mean, I think they had just started the NAACP a couple of years earlier.
Well, you know what they did do when they were talking about liquor? They talked about how they got these all these blacks down south, especially, but blacks everywhere, hooked on this bad rot gut liquor, and then they'd go out and commit crimes and rapes and so on. Remember that?
Yeah, I think they may have avoided the subject of the NAACP and all that because they didn't want to complicate the issue by bringing blacks into it in a big way, and you know.
Well, this was 1920-21, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, Ford was up in Michigan, way up north there. They didn't know anything about black people up there.
No, and you know, everything was basically segregated, really. So, I mean, it wasn't like now. I think, that their motives were that the motives were that which would require brave men. And of course the bravest one had to be Henry Ford because he had his name on it. And even though that Cameron did all that writing and so on, he wasn't taking any personal chances with his own life in the way that Ford was. None of them were. There was Ford. I mean, I think just he's a gigantic hero. Even though he put out that statement in the end and he stopped publication, tried to kind of half-heartedly of the book and so on. So we need to look at that next, I think, because that's the big question is how much strength did he really have, you know, and this idea, this thing about him letting Cameron say that Ford didn't know anything and Ford said that he didn't know anything about what this was about, which is impossible. And now he disapproves of it, you know, doing things like that, which could make him look kind of bad. But, you know, I look at it in a different way. Let me just throw in here because I have this little note here at the beginning that at the Nuremberg trials, Walter von Schirach, who was the top guy in the Hitler Youth and had some other responsibilities too. This is pretty well known, but he mentioned that the international Jew made a deep impression on him and his friends. I think they're asking him how they got into their anti-Semitism or something. He said, quote, "We saw in Henry Ford the representative of success, also the exponent of a progressive social policy. In the poverty-stricken and wretched Germany of the time, youth looked toward America, and apart from the great benefactor Herbert Hoover, who had been a part of a big relief campaign for Europe, it was even after World War I, you know, it was Henry Ford who to us represented America." And that was the America they would like to have found, but they didn't find, did they? the National Socialists. But there's always that connection made between Henry Ford and Hitler. And I think it's I think it's a valid connection to be made. I don't think it can be denied that Henry Ford saw Hitler as a positive force, even though he had given up his own newspaper and so on by then.
Well, Ford actually contributed money to the NSDAP, didn't he?
I think so. And he never spoke badly of it, and he might have even spoken well of it. But he was no longer, but he agreed, he probably agreed with their anti-Jewish views, knowing, because he understood what Jews were doing here. He certainly understood what they had done and were doing in Germany. So he was just being pragmatic when he himself had to stop, which we're going to go into now, what he had been doing. And I think that everybody doesn't have to do everything forever. He certainly did enough to for us to admire him greatly. And then he never really caved in the way they would have liked him to. They're not the Jewish, the Jewish attitude. You know, there's books coming out now. There's a book by this woman. I guess I'll jump down to that real quick. Her name, Victoria Saker Wooste, W-O-E-S-T-E, Wooste. These damn people with their German names. And she just, she's got to be Jewish, or she's certainly working for the Jews hard enough. But she's written this book, and I don't even have the title of it here. But talk about apologetic for, you know, talk about explaining all of this in a way that is so pro-Jewish and so anti-Ford. And she writes about the trial. Her final comment that I have from her here is that, where is that now? Well, maybe that's further down. Yeah, is that the most important thing, her book will argue, the most important fact about Ford's apology is not what it says. It is that Ford did not write it. And, of course, it's true that he didn't, and that Lewis Marshall wrote it, and Ford just let that be done by these other people, didn't even want to know about it, didn't even want to talk about it, didn't want to hear about it. Ford didn't sign it, but he knew it was being done still. So, you know, he didn't try to stop it. He allowed it. But that bothers them. That bothers them that it's known that he didn't really write that, and that wasn't really sincere. And they're questioning whether Lewis Marshall really did such a great job in the way he handled all that. Because it seems as though Ford has come out ahead of everybody else in the end. Well, you know, there's the trial to go into, and I've got, here's this thing about Eugene. I found a photograph, I found an image of the article in the Dearborn Independent in 1924 that was the one that this Aaron Shapiro had, didn't like so much, and, what they said in there is what he used to charge Ford with libel and against him, and that's where that he took him to court, and that's where that long court case came from. Well, it was long preliminary, but once it went into the court, I think it went on for about 2 years, and then once it got into the courtroom, it was 5 weeks or something, I don't know, shorter period of time before it was all over. But we know that at the end, Ford sought to settle. He didn't want to go on the witness stand, and I believe that's true. He certainly did not ever want to go on the witness stand and be asked questions. And he did a lot of finagling to get a hung jury and to get the thing settled out of court and so on. And by then, he was just ready to do what he had to do. So I've got a few notes here, but if you want, I've been talking away here, so if you want to add something here, that you think is important, go ahead, please.
Well, I just found something on internet interesting. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, uh-huh.
Right.
I can.
This is Jewish Telegraph Agency, February 24th, 2013. Wait, is it 2013, 2014? I don't remember. I'm not seeing it right now. Anyway, it says Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. It must be 2014. Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan denied he is anti-Semitic during an address to the group's annual convention in Detroit. Farrakhan, who is known for his diatribes against the Jews, compared himself to auto magnate Henry Ford, saying that Ford was a great man who was called an anti-Semite. "I feel like I'm in good company," Farrakhan said during a speech Sunday night to about 18,000 in Joe Louis Arena, the Detroit Free Press reported. "I don't hate Jewish people. I hate what is evil," Farrakhan also said, and added that Satan is control of Hollywood, as well as TV, the media, and money. So there you go.
Okay, so Farrakhan, yeah, well, what's the point? Farrakhan stands up for Ford. Well, we know he's anti-Jewish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there you go. Maybe he listens to this podcast.
Oh. Well, we don't know. Okay, this newspaper article, yeah, well, there's a lot of people who really like Farrakhan, a lot of white people who really like Farrakhan because of what he comes out and says, but this article in the Dearborn Independent was in April 1924, and the trial didn't take place until 1927, but it was there's a picture of it here. I've got an image of it, and there's picture. There's four men head shots there. One of them is Aaron Shapiro, and then the other one is Albert Lasker. And Eugene Meyer, who had been written about in the International Jews articles, and Bernard Baruch, who had been written about a lot. And Lasker was mentioned in connection with the baseball scandals. And all of these men are here as, I can't read any of it, but just the headlines. At the top it says, "All little pals together to save the American farmer." That's sarcasm like. And then the title, "Jewish Exploitation of Farmers' Organizations 2, must be part 2, The Story of the Shapiro Boys." That's written by Robert Morgan. But there it goes on there. That was the one that it said that he used to in his libel suit. So let me get this down off of here. Ah. I can't get this down. Okay, get this away. I looked up, I've got, I'll start here. A libel lawsuit brought by San Francisco lawyer and Jewish farm cooperative organizer, they call him. Again, this part is from Wikipedia. Aaron Shapiro said in response to anti-Semitic remarks by Ford, he led Ford to close the Independent in December 1927. So that was 3 years later. Well, it was April 1924 to December 1927. Before he closed it. Now this Shapiro, I talked about him in the first program we did for a little bit, but he was born in 1884. He was naturally the son of Jewish immigrants. At least he was born here, one of the few. He was born in California and from his Jewish immigrant parents. They say he grew up in relative poverty. Relative is,
Jew, right?
to the Jews. Despite this, He was able to obtain a law degree and gain a position on the California Markets Board staff. You know, and they say that seriously. Despite his background, he was able to do this. Isn't that funny? How all these poor Jewish immigrant boys or children of immigrants are able to go to these schools and get law degrees, and then move right up in the world. You know, yeah. If we did that, if we could get organized enough to take fine, just that's what the National Socialists were doing, as you know. I mean, they had the things based on merit, and they wanted to look at everybody's potential, all the poor kids, you know, get rid of all this elitism based on who your parents were, and find the talent and send them to school for free and educate them and make them into good National Socialists who would serve the people. Well, that's what the Jews do. They find all these people, and they make them all lawyers, you know, at least a whole big bunch of them. And they've got tons of lawyers running around. He was one of them. And so he got into the agricultural thing, and his plan was to he started this big plan, and he was organizing farmers. And it was supposed to be all just this great, you know, populist movement. But Ford didn't see it that way. Ford and his people didn't see it that way. They thought they were trying to take control of the farmers, just like they're taking control of the laborers and those clothing workers in New York and so on, you know, those huge numbers of people. And I'm sure they were right. And so they were trying to expose this, and so there they were head-to-head. And it says that Ford, this Victoria Saker Versteay, who wrote this article about her book coming out, Ford saw himself as the only legitimate champion of rural America, and he targeted Shapiro because he was Jewish and because he was not a farmer. Well, we know why, but if he wasn't a farmer, he wasn't a farmer, but there he was going to represent all the farmers, you know. And, they always make it look good, so he had quite a lot of people in his thousands, you know, in his groups. But in 1925, it was that Shapiro filed a federal libel suit in Detroit, requesting $1 million in damages, and for 2 years, she says the defense tried to prove that the articles were true, that the Dearborn Independent articles were true. Now, these were written after the International Jew, see? So this is what I find interesting. From 1924, 1925, they were still putting out the Dearborn Independent and writing all these articles about what Jews were doing, even though they weren't the ones that were part of the International Jew series. That's the way it looks to me. So he was still, you know, supporting all this expose work. And, the defense, did that, but, That wasn't working too well. So Ford's trial lawyer was a senator. Ford had good connections, too, you know. He was a sitting U.S. Senator, James A. Reed, from Democrat Missouri. And he finally realized, I don't know that senators today could be involved in a court case like that. Said he was a sitting U.S. senator, that you could, you know, be act as a lawyer in a big case like that while you were a senator. But I guess he could then. This lawyer finally realized, according to this woman, that he couldn't defend his case on conventional grounds, and he changed tack and he told the press that the only issue was Shapiro's professional conduct, not Ford's anti-Semitism. Well, they were, of course, trying to make it about Ford's anti-Semitism or about anti-Semitism. And so when they went to trial, they was only lasted a month and produced banner headlines and bizarre moments. And the trial, as it was moving toward its end, She says, of course, she's making it look a certain way. She says Ford became desperate to end the suit and avoid taking the witness stand. I mean, everybody pretty much agrees that with that. He ordered his bodyguard, Harry Bennett, here's where Harry comes in, to secure a mistrial. And Bennett planted an interview with a juror in a Detroit newspaper producing the desired result. I don't deny that that happened because Ford was pretty big on pulling strings behind the scenes as much as he could to make things go his way better and not having to do things he didn't want to do. So they may have set that up. It's pretty much widely believed. That doesn't mean it's true, but I wouldn't be surprised at it. You know, Ford was not an angel. He was not I shouldn't say it that way. He was a good man who believed in living by principles and so on. But he was not a goody-goody two-shoes person. He was a tough businessman, and he had enough toughness of mind to see who his enemies were and do what needed to be done is what I mean to say. So he was not a pushover. And this is where she says that Marshall made sure that Ford's apology was directed not to Shapiro, but to the Jewish people. Because at that point, Bennett says, Harry Bennett, who is a real close associate, somewhere in here they call him his here they call him his bodyguard. There's a long thing written by him. He wrote a book, and you can find it on BibleBelievers.com, www.BibleBelievers.org, sorry, not .com, .org, .au/Ford.htm, called Henry Ford's Forged Apology. Well, Harry Bennett took care of it all. Ford told him to, and he had been working as Ford's kind of do-everything man for many, many years. And he actually did have, he said he did, and he probably did. He said he whatever Henry Ford told him to do, he would do. If Henry Ford told him to go, you know, jump in the lake or something, he'd go jump in the lake because that was his attitude. He was working for Ford, and whatever he did, whatever Ford asked him to do. And probably pretty much true, although he then brags about all the things he didn't do that Henry Ford asked him to do, and he said, I wouldn't do it. But then he didn't get fired or anything. Ford just went ahead and did it himself or something because he wouldn't do it. So he's kind of a, you know, and he's considered now to have been soft on the Jews, and he says he never had any problem with Jews and so on, and maybe even working for the Jews at the end not being all that reliable in everything that he says, by Gerald L.K. Smith, who was also a friend of Ford's, and he's the one who said that Ford told him personally that he did not write that statement called the apology. Yeah. And he didn't sign it. And it was known that Bennett not only would do anything Ford asked him to do, but he could forge Ford's signature, and he did it a lot of times, and supposedly did it very well. So Bennett took care of that whole thing, and he signed it. But what he did was he went to Lewis Marshall, because Lewis Marshall had made it known that he would like to be of assistance in solving and settling this whole unfortunate problem. And so Bennett went to him, although Ford may have known about that. I don't think there was much Ford didn't know about. And to ever think people were doing things in his organization that he didn't know is not believable at all, because he was the kind of man, from what I've read, that he had his finger on everything, and he didn't need to write it all down either. And he just knew everything that was going on because he had built it up himself. So I'm sure he knew, you know, he didn't care. He didn't care at that point. And he thought, well, that was the best way to go about it. So Bennett went to Lewis Marshall. Lewis Marshall wrote what he thought, and you can find that on the Internet, too. There's an introductory statement by Marshall Then there's the statement signed by Ford. Then there's following that, there's a statement, some commentary by Marshall again. You know, it was all written by him, though. And that, then, you know, Ford was free of all that trouble they had there and went on with his business. But let's see what's left of this before we talk about what happened to the international Jew after that, if there's anything real important. Except this thing that Bennett writes in, we don't really have time to talk about that, but what, I think you read it, didn't you, or you went through it. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I browsed through it.
Yeah, well, I've got part of it copied here on my page, but I think I'm going to let it go because I pretty much said everything. He just gives a lot of anecdotes about his time with Ford and his what he thinks of other people. Like Leibold was Ford's private secretary, personal secretary. He'd been with him from the beginning. He knew everything. So he was in charge of the Dearborn Independent officially, and Cameron was hired as the editor. And there was another man who was editor first, and Cameron was a writer, but that other guy quit when he found out what they wanted to write in there, because he didn't want to talk about the Jews like that. So he quit. So Cameron became editor. And I was thinking that maybe Ford talked to Leibold, and then Leibold passed it on to Cameron. But I have seen elsewhere that Ford directly met with Cameron often, you know, and talked. He went and walked around. He went all around his holdings there and so on, and knew everybody there and talked to everybody and kept in touch with things. So, you know, that was, but he, Bennett describes Leibold as a squat, heavyset man with a short bull neck and close cropped hair who looked like a typical Prussian. Doesn't sound like he likes Prussians when he says that. And he had a Gestapo of his own within the Ford Motor Company. He kept elaborate files and had something there about everyone. Well, Bennett was supposedly the enforcer who had to go and fire people and so on. And but anyway, Bill Cameron, he describes, Bennett describes Bill Cameron as a short, stout, round-faced man who looked and talked a lot like W.C. Fields, with the difference that Fields was funny. I've heard that he was once a preacher in Brooklyn, Michigan. He came to the Ford Motor Company from the Detroit Daily News. Yeah, he was worked at a Detroit major Detroit newspaper for a long time before he. So Ford hired people who were good, you know, professional and experienced at what they did. But anyway, you know, you can see that he has he's trying to make these people out to be, you know, lesser and questionable by the time he's writing his memoirs here after Ford is dead. So, oh God, he talks about, here's what he says about, I guess I have time to say this. Here's what Bennett writes about how Mr. Ford sent me to New York to settle the case on June 9th, 1927, after the mistrial had been granted. Okay, he says, I got in touch with Arthur Brisbane. Remember Arthur Brisbane, Hattie?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a couple of chapters about him. He was editor of what? The New York, some big New York paper. It wasn't the Times, but Herald or something like that. And yeah. So he was a friend of the Jews. And so here he is. Bennett goes to New York, gets in touch with Arthur Brisbane, and through him, learned that the American Jewish Committee could settle the matter. So this came from Brisbane there. He was the man in between. I entered into negotiations with Samuel Untermeyer and Louis Marshall of that organization, the American Jewish Committee, and with Brisbane, the three of them. They drew up the now famous apology, he says, which was to be the basis for a settlement. In this formal statement, it was said that Mr. Ford would see to it that no more anti-Semitic material circulated in his name, and that he would call in all undistributed copies of the International Jew, which were booklet reprints of the Independence articles. For the rest, the apology said that Mr. Ford had no knowledge of what had been published in the Dearborn Independent and was shocked and mortified to learn about it. Now, this is what actually what Lewis Marshall wanted. And he talked he talked Untermyer into it, but he wanted Ford not to be seen as disliking Jews because Ford was so highly thought of and had such a following and all that he didn't think that would be good for Jews.
Because with Henry Ford supporting what was published in the International Jew in the Dearborn Independent in 1920 through 1927, you might end up with Louis Farrakhan saying, "I'm in good company with Henry Ford" in 2014.
Well, that's right. See, and that's exactly it. And so this was Marshall's plan to absolve Ford, and they wrote that there, but Ford didn't write it. And we have to remember, Ford did not write it. He didn't know ahead of time what it was there. He didn't sign it. He just said, "Do whatever you think you should do." He gave that to Harry Bennett, who he had depended on in spite of Bennett's. Ford was one of those men. Well, they say Hitler was that way, too. I don't know. Where he didn't mind a lot of his aides and people working for him having feuds among themselves as long as they were loyal to him. You know, that kind of thing. Maybe this was one of those things. But so he says, "Arthur Brisbane brought this statement to me at 1710 Broadway. I phoned Mr. Ford. I told him an apology had been drawn up and added, 'It's pretty bad, Mr. Ford.' I tried to read it to him over the phone, but he stopped me." Quoting Ford, "I don't care how bad it is. The worse they can make it, the better. You sign it and settle the thing up." Now, this is according to Harry Bennett. That's what he says. He said, and Ford said, we don't know. But anyway, he said, "So I signed Mr. Ford's signature to the document. I had always been able to sign his name as realistically as he could himself. I sent the statement to Untermyer and Marshall. The signature was verified and the case was closed. All this was done without Mr. Ford taking anyone else into his confidence," he says, "but himself. Etzel knew nothing about it, and Cameron and Senator Reed heard about it by reading the papers." Senator Reed being his lawyer. Cameron's reaction was quoted by the newspapers. Cameron said, "It's all news to me, and I cannot believe it is true." And, you know, Cameron was the one who in the courtroom sat on the witness stand and lied for Henry Ford and said he didn't know anything about what I was writing, never talked to me about it. I never talked to him. I just did it all. You know, I took responsibility for the whole thing, which anybody would know it cannot be true. But he said that anyway. And he was a Christian. he was a religious man, supposedly. But I guess putting your hand on the Bible and saying you're going to tell the truth doesn't mean all that much. Well, he didn't get charged with what is that when you lie to the court?
Perjury.
Perjury. But I did read that probably in this article that he went up and got lost in Canada after that, and nobody heard from him for a long time, and then he maybe was drinking or something. But anyway, it had to have been a very difficult thing for him to do, and to see the whole thing, you know, turn out what was happening with it and so on. So it took him a while to recover from all that, but he eventually did. So that is that story. And to go, what we're going to talk about, where is all that stuff? What's happened to it? Well, they say, you want to comment anything there before I'm looking for my place here? Go ahead.
Well, I was wondering why Ford himself never said anything about him, about his signature being forged. But I guess if we have it from Bennett himself, And Gerald L.K. Smith says that Ford also told him. Then I guess it's true.
I think it's true. And I think Ford just decided that he was going to make let that statement go out. He was going to live up to it pretty much. And that was just it. He wasn't going to talk about it anymore. He never did talk about it. He wouldn't talk about it, except privately, like he made those comments to Gerald Smith, according to Smith, which I think he's probably believable. But where is that where it says that when they started up again, when they stopped, and it's got to be after this. It was like in 1949 that somebody published the International Jew in that the abridged version, all in one book. But yeah, it was like all four volumes. But it was I don't know where that is now. I'm running around this long page full of stuff. June 1949, here it is, there appeared a 174-page, one-volume abridgment of the text titled The International Jew, subtitled The World's Foremost Problem, edited by George F. Green, who is not to be confused with the novelist and short story writer of the same name. It was published by this Green, who was editor of the Independent Nationalist, with an address in England. So the people, you know, and then it was also sold in the United States, where it was distributed by the Christian Nationalist Crusade.
Yeah,
so
that's Smith. Yeah.
Oh, that's Smith. Okay, right.
I believe. Well, yeah.
Okay, well, it could be. Anyway, he was somebody like that. He was involved in those kind of things. That probably is Smith. So that is, so it's these nationalists and these Christians who continue to support Henry Ford's work and all of this, much more like this BibleBelievers.org. And they support, of course, the protocols too, these Christian groups and Ford's work very strongly, because they think that it's Christian, you know, and it supports what they want. And they are some of the most loyal that keep it going and that stay interested in it. Probably a lot of the people who have listened to this series have been Christian people, and of various types. Mostly, though, the most loyal would be the type like the Christian identists, or just Bible Christians, you know, fundamentalist Bible Christians, more than not your liberal Christians. They're just the opposite. But this is, but it's, you know, they kept it going. They kept it alive. And Ford is, at some point in the early 50s, he called for, or somewhere I've got all this history here. I don't know where it is. He called to have the book never to be published again, or something like that, you know, destroyed and whatever. He didn't do it with any great, you know, he wasn't really able to do it. He just said it to make everybody happy. Mm-hmm. His family at that point, you know, he started getting kind of senile, at least probably 10 years before he died. He died in, 50 something, and it was in 40, I had that down there, 57. I think he died in 57. In 47, he made some kind of proclamation that he didn't want it ever to be published again. But nobody paid attention to it, you know, by then. I mean, it was out there. So, but his family was after him to not destroy the Ford Motor Company and to make amends and all this stuff. And his son was taken over and all of that. So he did a lot of things that he wouldn't have wanted to do, but
it seems to happen a lot, you know, with men when they get old, really old, the fight's not in them anymore.
No.
And
then their families are on them. And, you know, they depend more on their families then, and they care about them. And they can't fight their own family. That's even harder probably than fighting the outside world. So, yeah, you know, you can't blame them for any of that. So I guess in the little time we have left, we can come to some conclusions there about Henry Ford as a man and as a his contribution to our cause. And I think it's just great. It's just fantastic contribution. And I don't blame him at all for any of those supposed, you know, weak moments that he had, because he really had, I think he had no choice, and he did it fairly well. What do you say?
Well, I think that the international Jew is a very important seminal series of articles. It's a very important work. And the only serious flaw with it is its repeated reference to the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, which is superfluous anyway. You could produce an edition of the International Jew without all the references to the protocols, and very little would be lost.
You could do that, but yet they came awake to it in large part because of the protocols. And that can't be denied.
I don't think that's accurate. I think already started the series of articles before.
I'd like to look into that more, but you know, it's very hard to find any information when you get down to that, because nobody wrote anything, and they don't want, and there's so, you know, I think they're removing information that they don't want and changing it on the internet even. I just think it's getting awfully hard, but back, it says here, Bennett writes, back in May 1920, the Independent began publishing a series of anti-Semitic articles which ran for almost 2 years. These articles were based on the spurious protocols of Zion, which were exposed as a forgery in 1921. You know, he didn't like them, and he didn't like what the International Jew was doing. He didn't like any of that. He was not anti-Jewish, but he liked working for Henry Ford. So that was like a little separate thing, that these people had their own place and, you know, worked for Ford, and that was separate from what he did, but he didn't like it. So he wouldn't have anything good to say about it.
Yeah. I'm thumbing through the first volume of the International Jew here. The first few essays at least don't have quotes from the protocols in the front. And my understanding was that it was after they started publishing the series that somebody called their attention to the protocols and they started quoting from it. But
well,
we
don't have an answer to that.
They could have made the series perfectly well without that.
Well, but they might not have ever done it without that, is the point I'd like to make.
That's not true.
There's not more that we can say because time is up and we have to go. So, gee, Haddock, let's thank everybody for listening for all these months. And you say something quick.
Well, I see it's the sixth article in the series that is the first one that starts with a quote from the protocols.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much we've had a great time doing this show, and hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Bye from both of us.
Okay, goodbye, y'all.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.